That's Segundo here. And while unlike Yannick Murphy, I don't have many dreams of exotic dancing and Mata Hari, I corral my hopes for a far more noble ideal. Namely, the permanent end of alimony payments.
Okay, so I am here with Yannick Murphy, who is once again here. She's the author of Here They Come, and most recently signed Mata Hari. Yannick, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ed. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. First off, I wanted to talk about the perspectives in this book. This is a veritable medley of perspectives. You got first person, you got second person, you've got third person. You have first person for Mata Hari's early days, and you have this interesting third person near the end of her days, right before her execution. And there's also these second person asides, chapters beginning with clauses like, if you want to be a spy for the French, or if you don't want to become a spy, things along those lines. So I want to know how this kind of came about. Did you feel the only way to tell Mata Hari's story was through multiple shifting perspectives like this? Or?
Well, I started off thinking that it would be just in the first person, but there was so much about her in later life that I thought her mature-sounding voice would need a second person, and that's how the person began with, if you want to be a spy, that's how that voice came about, because it showed her being more mature about the entire situation, about all of the conflicts she had had in her life. And the first person worked for her as a young girl. It worked for me when she was a young girl. But then there was so much that happened in her life that I knew that that first person as a young girl, that particular sounding voice, wouldn't work for the whole book, because I wasn't going to write a book that actually detailed every point of her life. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a way to jump ahead and say, this is me with being Mata Hari. This is me having perspective over my life, about my life.
Interesting, because, I mean, you're going to third person, and the sense I got was that here Mata Hari has lost her voice. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if this, as this kind of came into being, this third person, whether the idea of taking away this identity was part of the kind of execution here.
Well, I wanted to let people know that what happened to her in the third person, and that's mostly the trial, when she's also in prison. Those scenes were in third person because I wanted everyone to get a sense that I was being fair, that perhaps she was guilty or that she wasn't guilty, and it was my way of letting the reader know that the possibilities were open. That I knew that with first person, I could engage the reader and you could sympathize with her. But towards the end of the book, when it was questionable whether or not she was guilty, I wanted that to be, I didn't want that to be my point of view pushed on the reader.
Got you. Well, that point of view, I mean, you have a number of symbols in this book that reflect a kind of oppression of her identity and of women in general. You have MacLeod, mm-hmm. who is not the most pleasant person in the world, far from that.
But he has a sense of humor.
he does have a sense of humor, and it's quite warped. I actually want to, maybe we should start by, before we get into this, because I have tons of questions for you. Did you use any source texts for this? Because, I mean, we're talking about this idea of whether she was guilty or whether she was a spy or not, and we're not going to know that answer until 2017 when they actually open the archive. So did you purely imagine this, or was this rooted in something?
No, there's been a lot written about her life, and there have been books and there have been things that you can easily access online, and really it was up to me to go through them and say, you know what, that sounds reasonable and that doesn't, and whatever I decided sounded reasonable was included in the book. There was a book, I suppose, written in 1985, I think it was, that the person who wrote it was able to look at some of the files. And that seems like a more factual record to me than books written prior to that, and also various things online that you don't know who wrote them and where the sources, where they got their sources from. But it was always an interesting angle to approach whether or not this would be a factual book, or how fictional would it be, or how factual would it be? It was probably the better way to put it, because a lot of the things that were factual, I felt, were too, there was too much news, there was too much information, which I feel really is negative in terms of helping the story progress. Too much news really deadens any piece of fiction. And so I wanted to make sure that there it wasn't filled with facts. So I even steered away from a lot of information about Mata Hari because I felt it would drag the piece.
Do you feel that the novel is a better place for speculating upon a subject as opposed to a biography? And do you also feel that the fact that there are so many non-specifics about Mata Hari's life allowed you to write this book, that it kind of fed the creative muse, so to speak? Or?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, for me, it was just easier to, it was just not easier, but it was more exciting, more engaging for me to write it in a fiction format. And I was able to imagine her voice. I was able to imagine what she was like as a child. And it was so much more liberating than being attached to every detail of her real life and trying to weave that through. At times, there were parts of her real life that were very fascinating and that I included in the book. But other parts I felt were not relevant to the type of story I wanted to tell. And when I first decided to write the book, I was really excited because I said, I had this feeling, you know what? Nobody else is going to write a story like this except me. And no one else can do this except me because of the way I perceived Mata Hari. You know, I knew that I could take off with her voice because of what she had gone through. It was so compelling that the voice came to me and I ended up taking off from there.
Really? So the facts that you were able to think about kind of caused you to become this ventriloquist then?
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, a certain number of the facts were definite springboards. Mm-hmm. And some of the facts I totally pushed aside and said, you know what, that to me doesn't interest me. But this really interests me, you know. For example, that she had these children and that she obviously, her motherhood was fraught with a lot of grief. And so I was able to imagine what that was like, being a young mother in a foreign country. Her husband is stationed in Indonesia, so she ends up being this very young woman with two children in a strange place, and I could imagine what that would be like.
Yeah. Now, the incident with the desk, I'm sure that was made up.
Yeah, that was made up. That's something that you can only make up, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
Now, well, I mean, well, I'm wondering why you had that particular exuberance to this sex scene, because it seemed to me to really celebrate the spirit of Mata Hari. I mean, literally, you break the desk. The sides break off, too.
Right. Well, I just imagine that I wanted to show that, obviously, she was committed to finding her daughter, and if this was the way she had to do it, then she would do it and have perspective on the situation and say, you know what, we broke the disc, now you really owe me.
Yeah.
Okay? She, and a part of her was a businesswoman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got you. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, were the symbolism in this book. You have a lot of curves and S symbols. Like, for example, the hair from Mata Hari is described as being S-shaped. You have the cuticles of fingernails. You have the moon. So I wanted to ask you how this elliptical concentration came about. It's almost as if Mata Hari stands as this curl that needs to be straightened out by the straight-laced members of society.
Yeah, I don't know how that came about, Ed. You know, those images just came to me, and only someone who is as observant as you are probably would see the connections. But that's what I love about writing any kind of fiction, is the more you state the object, and those were my objects, obviously, to keep re-mentioning the hair, to keep re-mentioning the cuticles of Bouchardon, who chews at them, and the shape of the moon. Every time I reintroduce those, I introduce them in in a way that maybe was a little different than the last time, but I never let the reader forget that I knew those were my objects I had to deal with. And then you, as the reader, does all the work for me. As you just saw meaning in those three things and how they related to each other. But that wasn't my plan, to make you see meaning in those three things specifically, except for the fact that if I keep stating them, will someone like Ed come forth with his own meaning for the text, and therefore you, as the reader, own the book because you've created your own image of it. And that's ultimately the excitement for me in writing any piece of fiction.
Well, that's a very good way out of an interpretation, but I have to actually counter with another point in the book, and that is the Gibbons.
Mm-hmm.
You have this Gibbon coming from the outside who MacLeod actually shoots, and you specifically use of the verb gazed.
Mm-hmm.
He gazed at her, not him. So using gaze instead of look sort of says to me, oh, male gaze. So where do you kind of deal with this ambiguity, and where do you deal with something specific? Because it seems to me I don't see how you could have used gazed subconsciously.
Well, I wanted it to be gazed instead of looked, because looked would imply something that was much more of a choice. Whereas gaze is obviously you could be half daydreaming and you know, taking in whatever's in your line of sight at the same time. So that was purposeful.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, where do you sort of hold back or kind of keep things ambiguous for the reader, and where do you feel it's important to sort of use a word like gaze to have a more explicit symbol?
I don't know. You know, that it doesn't... like I said, if I'm imagining that creature, then gaze is probably a safer word for me to use, because who's to say if that creature is actually looking purposefully at something? So I think, in effect, it gives me the opportunity to say to the reader, listen, no one's dead sure about anything. You know, maybe, it's another way of saying maybe. The word gaze just says, listen, maybe this was happening. I'm not sure, reader. I'm definitely not sure, but this is possible.
Mm. Do you find that symbols are a better way of expressing certain political and ideological points, or gender points in particular, in this book than hammering over the head through narrative? The actual, I guess, message comes in these interpretive possibilities as opposed to, say, just something didactic?
Always, yes. You would never want to hammer anyone over the head with anything, whether it be about gender issues or other political issues. For me, a reader will much more easily grasp the import of a situation if it's done through the revelation of objects or symbols rather than speech or news.
At what point did you know that some of the symbols you were using had a certain kind of ideological or loaded, I suppose, subtext to them?
I suppose I was hoping there was a subtext to them, but it's not till you really finish the book and read it all through with a more critical eye. You know, the minute I finish a book and show it to someone, I reread it and imagine I'm that person reading it, and how does that person take in what I've just written? How are they perceiving it? And it's a totally different place that you put yourself in. It's scary to go outside of it and imagine you're a critic or somebody you trust reading the book. And it's not until then that you can really say that symbolism worked, you know, that worked or that didn't.
So really it's a matter of, I guess, getting to it and getting a general kind of visceral sense that things are right, and just leaving the readers and the world to kind of digest it, I guess, or
right.
Masticate upon it.
Right.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you also about I kind of looked to them as match cuts, but the transitions from the third person in 1917 and the first person in earlier years. There's one moment, for example, early on in the book where Mata Hari is contemplating the darkness of the prison. And then you respond in the immediate next chapter at the very beginning with the white sands and how smooth everything is. And so this happens throughout the book, this kind of almost dichotomy. You see a clear kind of difference between these two. So how did this come about? Did you feel that you needed to have more of a connective nodal point for each particular chapter when you were writing the book?
Well, I think that whenever I'm writing, I like to show that there's opposites. I like to show that there's conflict because I feel that the conflict is what provides the drama in anything, and it can move it forward just by the nature of, in one chapter you've got the light, and the next chapter you've got the darkness. And that makes for movement, that makes for drama in any piece. And like you say, it's not something that hits the reader over the head. It's much more subtle and therefore much more satisfying as a writer to do.
Is it language that fills in that gray area between two points in a dichotomy?
Is it language?
Is language the sort of missing link between these stark contrasts?
Well, language is always what helps it move along. I wouldn't say it's a link so much as it's the fluid that it follows. It's the fluid that needs to go and move the story from one point to the other. It's the medium.
I guess maybe I should just ask you, what is that, that gray area? Yeah, I mean, what is the gray area between this point of contrast between chapters? Is that intended in symbols such as, for example, the hair that's in the prison yard that she constantly looks at? Or is it something that is specifically within, I guess, as she's gravitating from one end of the spectrum of her life to another, that the actual narrative point from beginning to end is more of that transition, that gray area? Maybe you can kind of talk about this.
Well, I guess I don't really know what you mean by gray area. The parts that aren't filled with lightness and darkness, I wouldn't say so much are gray areas, but they are areas that hint upon things that happen during the light periods or the dark periods. And I wouldn't categorize them as gray so much as maybe they're leading up to those periods, or they're hints of those periods.
So for you, it's more about extremes rather than gradients.
I don't know. I wouldn't like to pigeonhole myself that way, but maybe that's what you saw in this book, and that's why it's there.
Well, no, I'm just kind of curious, following up on your answer about wanting to have light and dark. Well, what about gray? That's kind of where I'm coming from with this angle.
Why don't I want gray?
Or where does gray serve a purpose in a novel like this?
Well, I suppose you could say that the gray is the second person when she says, yeah, you know, if you want to be a spy, this is what you do. When she comes up with that attitude, it's neither light nor dark. It's neither the periods when she was young or the periods when she was obviously in prison so much as it is this kind of outside voice of hers talking to the reader, so that the reader is almost with the writer in observing the story. You know, it kind of moves the reader outside of the book and says, listen, come along with me, because if you want to be a spy, reader, we can talk about this and also have this perspective over my life that I led. And it's a way of just putting the arm around the reader and bringing them through the writing and observing the story. So is that a gray area? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's a different area.
Well, that's, I mean, maybe it's more to do with this perspective. I mean, for example, I read Third Eye a number of ways. You make reference to the Third Eye many times. Now we can look at it quite literally, anatomically. We can look at it also as a mode of perception that is perceived, ironically, by the men who love, or lust rather, after Mata Hari. Or it could be a third eye, literally a third perspective or a third way of her kind of telling the story. So when did the third eye kind of enter the equation to this?
Well, I mean, that came about pretty naturally. I mean, that was obviously me imagining to be the doctor and seeing her anatomy and realizing that's not only a piece of anatomy, that it also is as powerful as the human eye can be. It also is something that her little portal into the world that she can see out of, and added to her complexity. The doctor who visualized that as a third eye was able to say to himself, that's not just any husband's wife there. This woman is pretty interesting. Look at all of the things that she has going on. Not only is she physically attractive, but she obviously has these ways of seeing the world that are interesting to me.
Speaking as a balding gentleman myself, I have to quibble with the portrait of this bald husband of Mata Hari's, because we see that he has this gradually receding hairline, but it's almost the way you describe it, I was going, oh, wow, you know, I didn't realize masculinity was, you know, you even have a butterfly land on top of his bald head as he's passed out in the road. So maybe this is more of the kind of curlicue or the crescent pattern that perhaps his receding hairline might represent, but I have to ask you about this. We bald men can be quite nice, too, you know. So.
Oh, yeah, well, she married him, so he must have had some nice qualities. Yeah. No, I think that the baldness was one of the facts that I read about MacLeod. So when you don't have that many facts about him, and there weren't that many facts about him, you definitely have to grab onto something, and that was the one object about him that I knew and that I could keep repeating throughout the book and give it some weight and symbolism that way.
Now, in terms of going back to the gibbon, for example, the gibbon sees Mata Hari but does not see him, and yet he kind of shoots the gibbon but does not kill the gibbon initially. So to me, this almost represented this kind of primal id, or this quality of like, look, if you could just go ahead and deal with this quality of yourself, you might actually have a good relationship with Mata Hari. Again, going back to this idea of what is there for the reader, how do these connecting sort of points kind of come together? Is it just the act of writing and kind of arranging things and having these connected points also between chapters, between the past and the future, that is this where this kind of Baroque puzzle kind of comes together?
I don't know. I mean, that scene when he's shooting the gibbon, I just specifically put it in there to portray that he was off in an evil direction.
Yes.
And that was the only purpose of that scene. I don't know. You're reading a lot into this, Ed. That's good, though. I like that.
Hope you don't mind. I wanted to actually also ask you about the many roofs in this chapter. The roof in Java is thatched, and the wind actually blows upon it. You also have the leak in Mata Hari's closet later in the book, and roofs don't seem to really have, again, much in the way of steadiness. So either you had leaking problems or something, I don't know, or this might represent something. Maybe you can talk about this.
Well, it's always advantageous for me as a writer to let the reader know what the setting is that the protagonist is living in. So if you, the reader, know that her place is in a shambles, that's got to have some effect on her actual characteristic of that day that she's going through or whatever. It's something that I think... I don't like to be specific about what a place looks like so much as I like to pick up on certain things about someone's surroundings so that it helps describe what the person is going through.
Going back to an earlier conversation about a year and a half ago, I want to actually follow up and ask you the same question in relation to this book. You revealed to me that Here They Come came very much from your own personal life. Now, here you have a book in which it kind of comes from another life. So I'm wondering, how did you draw from data in this case that you didn't personally experience and make it so heartfelt, number one? And number two, was it a matter of Mata Hari, again, as you confess at the end of the book, occupying your dreams? What's the relationship between personal experience and the kind of amazing dream rush of writing something down or racing to the computer to actually put it in?
Well, there was a rush to write this book, too, because there was the sense that, you know what? Everyone thinks of Mata Hari as being this ruthless spy. And it dawned on me, maybe, you know, just being naive at the time, but that, no, this woman had an entire life. She had a lonely childhood. She had a very upsetting marriage and a grief-ridden motherhood. And all of these things happened to her that, to me, were things that I could relate to. Not, yes, I'm a mother, not that I've had a grief-stricken motherhood, but just those parallels were easy for me to imagine what she may have been like. And in my mind, before I wrote the book, before I sat down to actually type the words, I had her voice running through my head. And if I had written all of that down, there would have been even pages and pages more of just how she felt about certain things that I wrote in my head and didn't put down on paper. But a lot of those things that I went through paralleled my own life at the time, what I was going through. This is, you know, if you want to be a good cook, you go into the kitchen and you pick up a pot. You know, that kind of voice stuck with me so that even during the day of my own daily life, I was able to use that same voice. And it was fun. It was fun being Mata Hari for however long it took me to write the book.
So you said you felt a sense of honor then. You wanted to honor Mata Hari's legacy or kind of at least
sort of correct it, perhaps? Well, it wasn't a sense of honoring her, and it wasn't a sense of correcting her either. It was just letting people know that the idea that she was only a ruthless spy was, to me, too ridiculous. Obviously, she was a complex person, just as we all are, and she had this past life. And I felt it was my idea that to show these other parts of her life and how those other parts of her life brought her into this predicament where, yes, she was condemned for being a spy. How did all that happen? How does all of a sudden one day someone wake up and they're, you know, they've been convicted for being a spy? All the things that happened to her in the past led her to that moment.
You clearly empathized with Mata Hari. What steps did you take to sort of ensure that you were going to show some of her bad side too?
Well, that was the third person parts. I definitely had to let everyone know that obviously she made some bad moves.
Actually, I wanted to talk to you again about the doctors in this book. It seemed very time specific, this notion of all these male doctors probing into womanhood and like, and I wanted to ask how that kind of came about. In fact, there really is no hope if you're a woman, based off of the story you tell, right, if you actually go and see a doctor.
Like I said, there were few facts about Mata Hari that were really interesting, and one of them was that she did get very sick and in Indonesia, and there weren't that many doctors there. So I imagined, what would that be like for a woman who has this loveless marriage and her husband at the time is obviously cheating on her. And here she is, still young, still attractive. And the only other people on the island may be the doctor who would be available that she could possibly meet and in private.
More than one sense of the word.
Right.
Yes.
So one thing to, after the other.
Now, MacLeod, you said earlier, didn't have a lot of data that you could mine from. So right. I'm wondering why you decided to make him evil.
Well, the data that was there obviously pointed me in the direction that he was evil. And he was the one who didn't want Mata Hari to keep seeing her daughter. So that to me was enough to say this man was
Did the sister-in-law come from your research too, that depiction? Because that was also quite sort of a slap in the face as well.
Well, she did have a sister-in-law, but to the extreme, the sister-in-law I portrayed, I don't know.
Did you set any ground rules in terms of where you can deviate and where you need to stick to the facts?
No, I didn't, which was really liberating, because I think if I had done that, then it would have been a more constricted sounding piece. But because I said to myself, listen, if you're going to sit down and do this and you're going to be Mata Hari, go 100% and make sure that you can do her from all different voices and standpoints.
Gotcha. There's also one moment when she can't buy chops from the butcher, because McLeod has put an advertisement in the newspaper. Did this come from anything specific?
That was an actual fact that
really?
I read.
Huh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Did this kind of, again, we're talking about this idea of all the women, particularly Mata Hari, being oppressed. Did this kind of repeatedly come up in the facts that you dug up? Or did this kind of come up in the course of liberating yourself by saying anything goes and telling this book?
Well, I knew that the husband she married was not faithful to her. And other than that, I don't think I knew his personality. No, all of the information about Mata Hari was really about her. And even then, there was not much that I learned about her personality through the factual information. I really had to make up her own personality.
Do you think too much has been made of Mata Hari through films, television, and books? And is your book a kind of effort to sort of restore the complexity instead of treating her as a kind of Garbo comic figure?
Well, I didn't set out to do anything for Mata Hari. You know, really, she's done a lot for me. She's helped me write this book that I could do in all these different ways. Structurally, this was a really fun book to write, because of all the different persons I use and the jumping back and forth between time, and letting that come really holistically was a lot of fun to do. Mata Hari, I think, yeah, got a bum rap. You know, I don't think that could happen again. I don't think a woman would be, actually put to the test the way she was today.
Yeah. Not just for her espionage or alleged espionage, but also this newspaper notice. I can't even see anything like that happening today.
Right,
I
mean, right.
In what sense does this kind of novel tell history, or kind of unknown history along these lines? Or, you know, should we, again, this is, we're getting into sort of thorny territory, because,
well, I mean, the facts that she ended up becoming an exotic dancer. You know, and what year was that? I don't know, it was the late 1800s, early 1900s that she started doing that. And that is amazing that a woman was able to get that far. And historically, that is important. You know, a lot of people probably didn't realize that someone could do that on their own after having failed at being an artist's model. You know, where do you turn? Where do you get your money from? If you don't want to become, high-class whore, you end up trying to reinvent yourself, which she did.
Well, Yannick, it was a pleasure chatting with you again. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Ed.
Thanks.